I mean, you know, when I first moved up there in 92, it was definitely in my mind to do something up there with literary gatherings, you know. But honestly, I couldn't find a place. I mean, I drank at a lot of bars. I drank with you guys at a lot of bars. But frankly, you know, drinking at a bar and having a good time and carrying on and having a meeting with guitars and books and whatever are two entirely different things.
Could work out.
Have to have a geography that allows it, like a one-room bar with a stereo and a television and everything. Even if you get tight with the owner, you can't do anything about it. There's no alcove or whatever. Then Rick got into the thing, and he would suggest places. Let's go there. Let's see what it's like. Let's see if we can have a gig here of some kind. And we never quite found a place. We looked in. We've sat in like at least half a dozen different bars and think, would a Jellicle Guild meeting go off well here? They concluded, unfortunately, no. But then every once in a while we come to Jacob Wurst, and about a year ago, we started experimenting there with bringing, when people would come into town, either in his end or mine, we'd start bringing them there and having little gatherings. Like my friend Barbara from Atlanta came up, and we had like a little round table thing there. A friend of his from New York came up, we did the same thing. Charette came up, we did the same thing. Meanwhile, we're getting along well with this barman. He always said hello when he came in, always friendly. The food's good. The atmosphere is cool. The setting is good. So basically, bottom line is that we established a rapport with the place. The place is geographically built to accommodate it. The place is cool. Then you and Jim were both saying, let's have a meeting up in Boston, which really got me off my can in terms of actually doing it, because I don't think I ever would have done it otherwise. It seemed to me like too much of a hassle. But I started thinking, well, if this is a desired thing, then I have to make it real because I'm the one that's living there.
Right.
So May 31st, it becomes real.
I think it's cool.
Well, my news, just for officiality's sake.
Officiality's sake?
Yeah. I'm going to be going to Emerson College this fall.
Yes.
And I put that in graphic terms in that cynical thing there. You know, contrived a little comment about the whole experience. And,
that was great.
I've been allowed to borrow just under $17,000 from the government. Somehow I managed to not default in the past 3 years. Which I always thought was a good idea. Don't default.
Yeah.
And I'm going to leave Quantum Books.
You don't want to default.
Yeah, it's not a good idea. I'm going to leave Quantum Books August 8th, 1997. After 3 years, 2 months, and 2 days.
Have we told them yet? Have we told Martin yet?
No. No, I'm not going to tell them yet. Right now I'm going through a 6-week reorientation, repatriation, something or other.
6-month orientation?
I don't know. It's like what happens when you're... It's like what happens when you've been captured by the enemy and then they bring you back home and they got to unbrainwash you or re-brainwash you or something. But no, it's too far in advance, and I don't trust them not to just do something straight.
Have you
Here's Charette, I know that heavy
Mark,
stuff.
Mark, hey man, how's it going? Glad you made it, man.
Oh.
How's it going? How you doing?
Well, and the reason I've been pulling so many hours is there's this woman in Arizona who's decided to go out and stress leave. And she knows a doctor who basically will give her stress leave for any reason whatsoever. Even if it is. She broke a nail.
Is that the doctor on the
list? Yeah. Oh! Yeah, Dr. Nick Riviere. Hey, everybody. Hey, Dr. Nick. Well, last week she actually checked herself into a mental hospital. And her husband came to visit. But someone else was visiting her at the time.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
I have to use the restroom. Just let me know when you're ready. Are you saying you're warming up?
Oh, yeah, I'm all set.
Okay.
Offering his comfort and concern. He cares.
Is he also married?
Yeah.
Suddenly their relationship sounds less funny and more problematic.
Yeah.
I mean, this girl at work is kind of funny, but when you see them at your party, they're kind of
offended.
Some
part of it.
Okay.
We're gonna start.
Yes, start with the.
Wayne Trenton.
Okay, now where should I put this?
Right there, on the middle.
In response to the many fine questionnaire things that I got back, one of the things that was said was that sometimes the recordings and the tapes don't come out too good, especially the music. So, here's an effort to remedy that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Hi. It's my latest
riff.
Good riff.
I don't have a title, but I'll give it one right here now.
Right.
Expression of confusion.
Right.
I'm here, and I cannot give you a single reason why. Not the afternoon. It's certainly not for the view of the woman with clownishly big eyelashes. Perhaps for the filling of the bright green marijuana t-shirt. As Zabin says, nice rap. But I am here. Here where Sunday's astonished with their slowness. Like a heart slows before surgery. But there's no sound but that of the quiescent bum lapping expensive soup from a paper cup. I came here first for the wood, and then the active encouragement of the art of the loiter. I came here when there was more than syndicated crap on AM. I came here first when I was 13. And the place where I'm here wasn't. I came here first any number of times, some beyond memory. But I am here today. Less than a week after a slushy snow enveloped here, less than 2 weeks after here ceased half its meaning for me. I am here. Don't know why.
First came to Zoomers when you were 13?
Well, I meant here in Hartford.
Hartford.
And,
yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah. There were a number of firsts for Hartford.
Zeus is only
around
for a couple of years.
Huh?
Zeus is only been around for a few years.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, this is from the book You Two at the End of the World by Bill Flanagan. And it's kind of like a rock fight. Yeah, rock fight I would read. And it came out right around, it detailed them right around the time of the Super Bowl.
When did it detail them?
Zero Five.
Oh, Zero. Well, that was the last album. Right?
Yeah, well, the book is about a year.
Yeah.
But it actually details a lot of stuff earlier. It explains a lot of stuff that you didn't know. Explains the whole Sinead O'Connor thing.
Oh.
Well, it does it in a really interesting way. This book came out in 1995.
I looked at that book at a bookstore one time, and it seemed pretty good.
It is. It's not like...
The guy pretty much went around, drank with them, and talked to them, and really got into their thing.
Yeah, it's not like a publicist book.
Yeah.
This is really... In fact, most of the book is like...
It's more like adventures with you two in a certain way.
And maybe this is where the adventure is. This is entitled Chapter 39, Under My Skin, and it has some stuff. The walking tour enters its third day. How Edge lost the secret of the universe. Bono dubs a Sinatra duet. The old fool controversy. Secondhand smokers. A pub crawl with Gavin. And Michael Jackson loses face. You know, just because I have to hang on Bono's coattail for every gin mill juke joint pool hall and pub in Dublin doesn't mean I have to drag you along with me. Let's skip ahead 24 hours to Thursday, Thursday of the week of the Dublin concerts. You haven't missed anything. Bono's still coming up with excuses not to go home. He's still in the same clothes he had on since he got off stage in Cork on Tuesday. We're both still awake and engaged in one of the greatest walking talkathons since Johnson jabbered to Boswell. Do you know the story of how Edge lost the secret of the universe, Bono asked? Oh boy, a Hibernian folktale. No, Bono, tell me. It started when Edge got a jar of psychedelic mushrooms, Bono begins, as wise as I'm hoping this. The legend, in summary, goes like this. Being very scientific, Edge decided that if he was going to sample any psychedelic mushrooms at all, he might as well eat the whole jar. Apparently, those were potent fungi. Edge's eyes spun around and his hat flew off his head. He figured he'd better not take a chance on any impressionable members of the YouTube fan club seeing him like this, so he went upstairs and got into his bed. He lay there for a while and then imagined he heard his wife calling him. He went to the door. No one was there. He went back to bed, and then amid kaleidoscopes of spinning dimensions like an old Doctor Strange comic, Edge was given the secret of the universe.
I'm sure you're going to say Doctor Who, the opening passage. I'm sorry, but go ahead.
He was given the secret of the universe.
Wow, he thought the secret of the universe. I am no fool. I, Better get this down on tape. See, Edge reckons he was not the first traveler in the astral plane to grok the SOTU, but that others might in their altered state just assume they would remember it. That's where they goofed. Edge would take no such chance. He swam over to his shoulder bag and found his Walkman. He turned it on and began laughing hysterically at the little red light.
Oh, God.
Laughing hysterically.
I was just pissing at him. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
Finally, the scientist within got control. He regained his composure and spoke the secret of the universe into the recorder. His duty done, he put down his Walkman and exited Earth altogether. Upon returning the next day, Edge got out of bed, went down to the kitchen for something to eat. When he opened the refrigerator, more than one light went on. Hey, Edge thought, I learned the secret of the universe and I got it down on tape. He ran upstairs, found his tape recorder, played it back, and heard himself say, complete gibberish. Badly recorded gibberish too, as he seemed to have been holding the Walkman upside down when he taped it.
Oh man. Oh, to poor Edge, who had it and lost it.
Poor Edge, he lost his corners.
He lost his corners.
Oh man, that sounds like something I heard Townsend
went on an airplane and was doing some SPP. Problem was, he thought he lost his head. Somebody started in the clouds or something. He said he wasn't really happy again until he landed. And, I'd share that with you. STP can do that. You lose certain body parts. Apparently, it's a very pleasant experience to lose one body part.
Did you ever lose your body parts, Jim?
I lost my body many times. But not just one part of it. You lose all of it. If you're up above looking at it down, that's okay.
You said you corporeal for it.
Yes. I did a few times. And you're what type of a party, you're just outside looking at yourself, leaning in a bar. It's amazing looking at everything else from a different perspective. It was caused by psychedelics, but still, it's really an amazing experience. I urge everybody to try it. You might enjoy it. I mean, you may not, but you're telling me to think about it.
Promoting the use of psychedelics?
Absolutely.
Young man?
As much as possible. But I stopped. I realize that the problem is that if you do too many of them, you really can't function in the mainstream for any length of time. You can try, you can play a game with it, but it's really difficult. It's very, very hard. Very, very hard. Once you see the truth, it's hard to go back.
Promoting the use of psychedelics. That could be.
You're out of the blue and into the black.
Out of the blue and into the black. Oh, wow, I can make a time limit. Okay.
Okay.
I'm going to read some poems, and then something else is going to happen. Now, do you remember the poem, The Ruby Virgin Subversives? I read it back there.
Yeah.
We somehow ended up out there. Well, I'm going to read that again, and the reason I'm going to read it is because it set off a series of waves in of thinking. Anyway, this idea of the Ruby Virgin really interests me, and I'm not quite sure what it means, but it's an intriguing phrase. And
the Ruby Virgin?
The Ruby Virgin.
That was that little thing that has a lot of nerve endings between the legs, located on the top.
Yeah. Yeah.
The Ruby thing.
Yeah, I've been obsessed with the Ruby Virgin for about 5 months now.
Oh, okay.
Trying to figure out what exactly she
sure
is.
Talking about the same thing, right?
Well, we are in a certain sense. And in a certain other sense we're not, but in a certain other sense we are.
Listeners.
Clitori. Yeah.
Plural.
Kuntz, who write the clitoridae. Okay. Anyway.
Anyway.
We've gotten an arc.
That's in the back of a dollar bill, too.
Here!
Feel a little bad. Yeah, yeah, indeed. Well, there is an inverted triangle.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, I saw some of those rafters from the ceiling. Yeah. Oh, there was... Oh, did New Jersey dismantle the Canadians yet? I know they won a game of triple overtime. Played like they won a game of triple overtime or something ridiculous.
Yeah.
Well, that was an occasion. Anyway, I had
a
thought about that.
Okay, so I'm gonna read about, seven poems, including my LSD poem. Indeed. Okay, I'm not gonna read the death poem. It's not very long. It's not very good. Okay. The Ruby Virgin Subversive. This was December 21st.
Excuse me.
One. I imagine her naked. It starts out this way. Her nightgown was a light wind. I walked it over her head. I'm still imagining her naked. This doesn't end. This universe doesn't include you. It's fit for two naked bodies, is all. Two. This universe fires with life, derived from her cheek and breast. Her voice, its sweet darkling wind. Her wondering eyes as I enter her deeper. This universe, two bodies, boundless. Odd measuring of space and time. Each flaming touch is a star. Each spasm marking empires risen and fallen. Three. It's about the sky sprayed with carnal lights. It's about the thousand oceans in her hair. It's about hard pulse pursuing soft prayer. It's about ruby silken loops thrilling lit. Throbbing becomes wanting song, entwining a movement out. Thin lips open for sad cosmic gain, nothing sated, hunger trembling still. Four. Her hands, curled, cupped, and solved, lather despairing skin with sleep. Perform erotic acts vaguely sacred, offer discouraged blood-bright sermons. These hands will dull your scars, you need before you believe. Your belief runs fast, smoking. These hands are new. You've snared them. Five. Blue eyes fled after burden's dawn. Retreat was panicked and futile. Blue eyes returned with fall of new language. Discovered the tangle contained divine fury. Covered in violent words now, blue eyes opened wider, more light. Covered in hungry words now, blue eyes closed, felt something new. Seven. Her voice, a sweet darkling wind, remembers the intense blank time, sings when unheeded of a mystic shore, when still a creature at a ragged gallop, presses a gospel of staccato breaths and several hopes of rest and sweetness, sometimes becomes a carnal wind, an exhale of wet puffy icons. Seven. Her breast thrashes, relents, and laughs, laughs, proselytizes, and laughs, becomes minister to fiery want, declaims convention black enemy. We'll give more, we'll learn how, we'll thrash and laugh for the wet life, we'll conquer pink sheet tendencies, we'll bloom as rain and darkness comes. Eight. Her nightgown and I was furious, a shell of cream and pink frosting, a lie, a worthless toy, static, god of denial, god of inhibition. The heresy in your world is to want nakedly. The sin in your world is wild blood. The crime in your world is world and joy. I urge the gown over her head. Nine. When her thighs approach me for truth, I shift and beg their command. Give us your truth, no less. Enlighten, slave, I recall and comply. Recall an earlier moment, ruby fright, a dubious young universe, dry, disbelieving. A nightgown of shells, ruby virgin, cut away fresh from your stiff garden. 10. And the first hour of the first day came and passed and was good. Runes of joy and pain bespoke coming patina. The second hour calmer, less taken with taking. The third hour was the first crushing mate. The fourth doled out packets of powers. These powers toward skin, limbs, hair. The first day ended with vaginal pageantry. 11. New universe of segueing flesh. Governed from strong want, busted out. Each day disfigures me more happily. Sing to me, a mirthful canker, sing. The ruby virgin is mine henceforth. twisting into knots my weaknesses and dreams, allowing my red madness when it comes, applying wet skin to my rotten seams. And that is that. Okay.
That's very good. Right now. Vaginal pageantry.
Yeah. Carnal wind. Yeah. I was rather out of my mind when I wrote that. I wrote in the hotel of the Westin, in the lobby of the lounge of the Westin Hotel in Boston, and yeah, I was rather out of my mind. but that's kind of good.
Yeah.
This poem I wrote for Jim's daughter. Jim's daughter Belinda, his elder daughter, is fascinated by colors and seems to always want him to write poems about them. And sometimes she asks me for advice about writing about poems. She says, you know, what should I write about? And I say, well, write about something other than colors, because she says I have nothing else to say. But she doesn't want it. She just wants to write about colors. So after, I guess, a visit to down here, and she was talking about colors and all, I decided to give her my take on colors. And I thought it over real hard. I was sitting at my favorite joint in Harvard Square, the Avantan, and I was thinking about colors, and I was thinking about Jim's daughter and her precocious efforts at art, as it were. And I wrote down a list of colors to write about, because I figured, well, if I'm going to write about colors, I'm going to like write about them in order of some kind. And in any event, I ended up with a poem called poetic sequence called Colors a Life, to BRB. Darkness told of other places when I was young and scared, of music strange yet possible, of a secret prosperity and the third eye's unsealed hunger. The air was black before me, my night was young but shuddering to see. Black and blue at my something's dawn, noises in the trees, blue shadows on the lawn, so blue and thus imagining only blue songs. My blue aura, old eggshell, dragged along. My something's dawn grew ever more blue. Blue so prominent in those years, please, blue strands, return me. The brightness of youth as it yellows, sunshine dances, crowds of song, awake, afloat, if but a while, become ye a salve where the cosmos hurts. A prick of brightness on its struggling skin. Let go when the rays go slant. Don't hang on, costume old and tight, you can't. The need to plant wrecks freedom. To own a live piece, make it shake. To need to plant, to own, to make. To draw from earth loving flesh. To flesh from earth rendered clay. You are not machine, you are green. Growing old, adding flesh, place to lean. Red is a rising, a funkiness, a wrap, cupping the fire in unburnt hands, carving from chaos, contriving a petal. Become a jouncy maker of invisible seams, become a teller of unclenched time. Red, the fat giver of heavy dreams, red, taunting, transfiguring what seems. Soul become pink, mature and high, a new passion grips where once clung the old. Alone with the skies, alone with the past, pink descends, focuses the eye. Pink swathes, clarifies the ear. In dusk, something, dawn something returns from fear. The something is calm spirit, a nest, a flight. The gray offers rest beyond the snows, soft air welcoming to nests and flight. Other colors beyond the gray fade, release. Colors are old, familiar, stretched to ease. Beyond the gray spatters of light. I remember the blacks and the black and the blues. What remains, dry smears of color, something spotted with life. And I'm sure Belinda understood every word of that.
Yeah. Oh, man, that was good.
Yeah.
That was great. Very good.
Yeah.
She asked me about that. I told her to read it again.
So this is a poem that it was in a letter to Rick originally, but anyway. Okay. The night is covered with white tulips, shaking a frightened hand. Tulips turn to ash, love a fading flash. Absence reigns with cold, colorless eyes. A frightened hand must bloom, become white tulips, float with winged gold, wetly, wetly alive, love a shiny smack, absence dread pulsing flight, pink-cheeked might. The ruby gown lies in white tulips, glowing virgin shivers, a curl, a curve, a hand, love our branding marrow, absence portrays youth, fat with want. Releasing to falling tulips, and night's fell talk, a masquerade, a kiss, love is reality raw, absence gulls and begrudges. White tulips in a patch of light, tender chili flakes, a handful seal broken veins, love will come tomorrow, absence subsides as the virgin rises.
Very good.
It's a poem about snow.
Absence of size of a
yeah, white tulip. Snow became white tulips in my rather proto-LSD vision.
Well, whatever works for you, you know.
And this one I wrote at a party that I was at. And I ended up, I didn't give it a title at the time, but I ended up giving it the title Soulard and Amante. And when you hear it, you'll probably be able to figure out why, not too, without too much difficulty. We crave beauty. We are obsession. We dance madly. We love everyone. We crave beauty. Exhausted, we crave beauty. We are obsession. We dance madly. Whirling till spent, we crave beauty. Mm-hmm. And that's about...
That was very good. I like that. I like that. That was very good. I like that.
Simple and do it.
We crave
beauty. Okay. I wrote two LSD poems. First one is the beginning and the second one's at the end. I neither recommend LSD nor do not recommend LSD. Just do it or don't do it. But don't blame me. So the first one was early in the experience.
And you couldn't finish it.
Hmm?
That's all you couldn't finish?
I finished both of them.
Oh, you did.
I tried to take notes. I wrote a poem, and then I wrote a couple of really sloppy, silly things.
I tried to do that. The first time I took it, I think I couldn't have possibly written these, because I had no physical body.
Yeah. It was silly, but I did get two poems out of it.
Yeah, that's cool.
And I'd like to think that the first one reflects, I think, what entering the state of being under the influence of LSD, I think initially, like your first time, you don't know what to expect. You have a bunch of, things you've heard and whatever. And the first poem reflects, I think, what not knowing anything, not the beginning, like what the trip's going to be like. And the second one kind of reflects what the trip was in the end, like you hadn't gone through the experience. So the first one is more general. And then the second one is more, in a way, specific to me. So anyway, the first one goes, nothing yet, high is high, no other. There is no we, there is no I, high is high. Pages of poetry, all blank, there is no here. And,
That was the beginning of it,
all right. Give me a hallelujah if you recognize that state. Not necessarily under acid, either.
Hallelujah, brother!
Yes,
here is high, oh my.
Yeah, silly ass bullshit.
Anyway.
Buddhist,
no,
bodiless
very,
stuff.
Yes.
However, the second one, which was written... the second one was written about... in terms of... Corporal Time was written about 18 hours later, I'd say.
Is it corporeal?
Yeah. But the experience itself was so out of time and relevant to time that, I mean, it was just...
As Swami Prabhupada would say, time distortions ensue.
Yeah. So anyway, I wrote a poem and I ended up calling it to Hartley. Hartley is David Hartley, who is Rick Amante's friend, who lives in a town called Melrose, Mass.
You know Melrose would be good for something. I'm dry town, but the guy got too much from dry
town with a major drug taker in the middle.
Right.
So, if you ever want to have another time to research, the fact you can work at 70 hour a week.
Yeah.
You hallucinate after.
Wonderful,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, anyway, this poem is in some ways. It's all jolly. This poem is something more to my liking because essentially Rick's friend Hartley is from New Jersey. He's this guy in his 30s. He's a musician. He does some kind of graphics design or I don't know, something for work. Very nice guy. He's got a kind of a sarcastic Jersey attitude, but very sincere. And I couldn't think of a better man to have dropped acid with, which is, I suppose, a good compliment. And we had a long talk about art. I mean, you don't sleep on this shit. You just, like, you're awake. I couldn't close my eyes for almost 24 hours because I was afraid to. Finally, at some point the next day, I think it was, it's like we started the evening Saturday night.
You may,
and then
you may think you were afraid to, but you just said you wouldn't be able to sleep.
I thought I was afraid to close my eyes, and I didn't, so.
You wouldn't be able to.
But I did sleep at a certain point. There was a bit of sleep, but mostly through most of the experience, I was afraid to close my eyes because I thought I was going to really see some weird shit, and I didn't want to. I was seeing weird shit as it was with my eyes open. I was afraid to close them because then my brain would, its own imaging processes would take over completely, and then I mean, this guy turned into Bill Cosby at one point.
Yeah, you tell me. I saw Uncle Sam Conner on the radio.
Yeah, and he had a computer. We were like in his living room, and he had a computer screen. And I couldn't see the thing. The computer screen was this fuzzy, glowing, nebulous stuff with the damn light show. I couldn't focus my eyes on it. It was very bizarre.
That's when you just enjoy the lights. Enjoy the lights.
Yeah. So anyway, Hartley and Rick went out and got bagels. They said we should get some food, and I said no. I just want to sit here alone for a little while. The substance of the previous night's talk. Rick was very quiet the whole night. He had a weird trip, and I think he was a little. He had a mellow, benign, lovely encounter with annihilation, I think it was. Anyway, it wasn't bad. It was just
to talk with him about that.
Yeah, it was. He lay on this couch that exactly fitted him, and he looked like he was in a you know, what do you bury people in, boxes?
Coffin.
He was in a coffin, and this weird smile on his face, and his arms are folded. It's like just throw flowers on the guy and, you know, put him on the ground. He lay like that for hours and then it was very bizarre. But anyway, Hartley's this weird kind of guy, and he and I had a talk about art. It went on for hours, and he told me about the early Grateful Dead, and we talked about art, and I got to this point where I thought, art, what the fuck's the point? Why even bother? Who cares? What difference does it make? And that really kind of scared me, because I figured, well, eventually I'm going to come down from this high. And if I don't have anything left, then, you know, I can't take LSD all the time.
Well, that's it. You see through, when you see through art, and the problem is when you do this stuff, which I get a lot of it, but it gets to the point where you can't function.
Yeah.
Mainstream seems self-defense.
But you know what I've come through since? LSD helped me see through art, and since art has helped me to see through LSD, I've realized I had to make a choice.
Yeah.
I've chosen art.
You get too much.
I mean, now that they've broken the record for the longest fucking prologue in the entire world. All this by way of saying I recently dropped LSD for the first time, which I wouldn't know how to tell everybody otherwise, but it was an interesting experience. It's not something I really want to cover up. I wouldn't want to share it with the cops, but, you know, you guys are friends.
I think you should share it, yeah. I think it's good to, I'd like to see one of my, The only guy I've known in 10 years was in the last.
And I did this for the purpose of, I was ready to do it, but mainly I've been writing this novella for the summer about the 60s. And we're reading all these books of various kinds, some of them really wonderful. And I'm learning many wonderful things about the 60s. And I've been lost in the 60s so much that, in a way, half the time I'm not even here anymore. And, God, this is just never going to end. I was sitting at South Station today, one of your favorite places, Mark.
Yeah.
I had a little time before the bus, so I just thought, I'll sit here, I got some food, I'll sit here. And I was reading my book, The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test by Tom Wolfe. And I was deep into this story of stuff that was going on in San Francisco around 67, with the hippies and Hyde Ashbury and stuff. And I read and read and read, and then I looked up and I realized, wow, it's 1997 and I'm in Boston, and you know, what I'm reading about is like ancient history, and half the people sitting around me weren't even born then. And it just seemed a very strange fact. So when this opportunity came to do this, I did it partly because I figured, well, if I'm going to really do the 60s, I don't want to do it as some kind of fucking sociology project. Bad sociology, you know, like not immersing yourself. I want to know what it was like. And acid was very much a part of the scene in terms of consciousness exploration. And I've never done it. I've done marijuana. I've drunk. I tried cocaine. I didn't like it. I think I did speed that weekend as well. I don't know. And of course there was the hash thing last summer. Fire up the nine. But the thing that Jim had always advised me, acid guru that he is, he'd always said, if you're going to do anything hallucinogenic or psychedelic, make sure that the setting is right. So I knew that Rick went to see this guy that he'd been friends with for a number of years, and they would basically do a lot of drugs and listen to music, have these heavy philosophical discussions. And Rick's cool, and he vouched for his friend, and I said, okay, I'll come out with you guys, we'll get together, and there was no pressure to do it or not do it, I just basically said, I'm here to do it, you guys are into it, let's do it. So I had a really very out there experience, probably most of which is not describable and all that stuff they usually say. But in any event, 18 hours into the event, which now brings us to Sunday afternoon, they went out to get bagels or something, some kind of food, and I said I wanted to sit alone for a while and just relax. And the radio was on to some nice classical music, and I was sitting there, I read a little, and I thought, you know, I've got to write, I've got to deal with art and LSD at once. And I'm not hallucinating Bill Cosby images anymore. I'm sort of... See, what happens is you reach a point which is called peaking. And when you're peaking, from what I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, when you're peaking, the LSD is having its most potent effect. And often that's when you're, you know, mushrooms are growing out of the ceiling and you're... Whatever is happening, you're so completely... Your pores are so open to the universe that whatever's going on is going on most... Enormously.
If you have a lot of beers, wave your hand in front of your face, you see some afterlifes.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, ghosts. And that's a very common message. With acid, that means you wave your hand and you see five hands that stay there.
Yeah.
And you, it's hard to deal with.
So I was sitting there.
Five disembodied hands.
So I was sitting there, I was thinking about the long conversation. I was still deep into this LSD thing. I mean, this thing didn't, I did not... quote-unquote, recover from it.
It didn't take 24
hours. It took longer than 24
hours.
It took, from the time it happened Saturday night, and it was like till Wednesday before I was recovered.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm sitting there alone in this guy's house, and he'd just been a really great guy, sort of guide to the trip. And he and Amante were out, and I'm sitting there, and it's like, okay, I have to write something. And I ended up calling this to Hartley, because in a way, the experience was so tied up with him, his house, his drugs, my trust of him, his friendship with Rick, that it just seemed inevitable. And when you hear it, I mean, I don't know, whatever. To Hartley. Ground that is never absent to wishing lips. Enough sunrise to console 3 a.m.'s dark prayer. The sadness you keep after a moment of crowded woe. The will to meet eyes and hope for bells your glance provokes. Absent God, absent lover, absent mother, worse, present all at once. Art, the horn cleaved in your heart as you dangle in reddening darkness. Art, the horn cleaved in your heart as you dangle in reddening darkness.
Redmond.
Yeah. Yeah, so anyway, that was the LSD funk. And, yeah, that was...